We're delighted that so many of you are here and you're here to hear a truly wonderful friend of the school, amazing person, and of course someone that can do 2 million calculations per second in their mind and then was overtaken by a computer that could do even more. But we prefer the human and we prefer him because he's not only the person who has number one ranking in the FIDE World Chess Championship ranking for all time, the longest person to hold that position. Incidentally, one of his students has just become the number one. So that's what happens when you're too good a supervisor. you get overtaken over time. But he's also someone who has devoted his life to trying to not only spread the ideas that chess brings and started a foundation which has brought over 3,000 people around the world, 3,000 schools around the world, chess capacity. So a foundation which is building skills, but also of course someone who tried to reform the Chess Federation, recently stood for the presidency of the Chess Federation, and more broadly has tried to reform society. Gary was one of the first to stand up against Putin, a leader in the human rights struggle in Russia and in many other countries, and is now the chairperson of the Human Rights International Council. Gary, at the age of 22, became the world chess champion, the youngest ever, and of course he's known for his extraordinary genius of inventive style. He was one of the first people to think about machine intelligence. Many of you who love chess might have tried, as I did, to beat the level one Kasparov computer 30 years ago, and that has remained a fascination of his, and of course is the title of his lecture today on the limits of human intelligence and artificial intelligence. It was about 19 years ago when a computer was able to finally exceed his capacity. But this challenge continues in many dimensions, and Gary will talk to us about this interaction. In addition to his many activities in human rights as a democracy campaigner in Russia, and elsewhere, he of course has written very widely, and his book, How Life Imitates Chess, is now available in over 20 languages, and he contributes many newspaper and other articles. In the Oxford Martin School, we're delighted that he's a senior fellow. He's been engaging over the last days with many students across Oxford on this question of the interface of human intelligence and artificial intelligence, and this is his fourth visit to us. The first was for a debate in which he, together with Peter Thiel, debated Ken Rogoff and Mark Shuttleworth on the question of whether innovation is speeding up or slowing down, and that continues as well to be a fascination of his. So, Gary, we're absolutely delighted to have you back. We're delighted that there's such a strong interest, and we very much look forward to hearing what you have to say. Gary.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Ian, for this introduction. I'm always afraid to hear introductions, because these days everybody looks at Wikipedia, and the greatest fear is to find out something you never heard of yourself. on the way here, Ian told me that this is a building where many students do not have sort of positive feelings, because you take exams here. So I'm also very nervous now, because I was in university a long time ago, but everything happens at the last minute, and I tried to be very ambitious and to include in today's talk some of the results of our conversations that we had here yesterday at Martin School. There was the workshop And today also there was the seminar at Said Business School, and I wanted to incorporate some of the findings and some of the results into the speech, which, you know, as always, you know, delays the preparation, and I'm still waiting for some of the slides being delivered. So, yeah. But the good thing is that, again, this it's not an exam, and the subject that we're going to discuss today, unlike, you know, some of the concrete exams, do not have results that can be proven by our past experience. It's about the future. So, of course, we can rely on some of the past experiences, but at the end of the day, this discussion has no right or no wrong answers, because we're making a lot of assumptions, and I'll try to share my own experience and again, the findings from our conversations and seminars here in Oxford, and try to present, you know, my view of this future. You know, I want to say distant future, but at the end of the day, you know, it's the future happens instantaneously, and sometimes, you know, just before we expect it to come. Actually, today I was trying to look at the day in history, and I found a couple of good things, you know, in Wikipedia. I'll mention them later because I need slides for that. But one fact, you know, that is, I don't need Wikipedia for that because it's related to me. So very often when my name is mentioned, people immediately say Deep Blue, IBM, chess match. So, and actually, in February 1996, I played a match that unfortunately nobody remembers because I won it. It was the first one. Everybody talks about the second one in New York, but this one was in Philadelphia. And yesterday was, by the way, it's an important day. It was a milestone because it was the opening game of the match, and I lost this game, but I won the match. So today was the second game which I won, so it's more pleasant memories. But still, you know, there's some great memories, because it's the first time when I, you know, I faced a machine that was able to not just to play chess and do some decent moves, but also was capable of being world champion. Also, looking back at my history on the top of the world of chess, from 1985 to 2005, you know, I'm puzzled whether to think it's as a big success related to the computers or the opposite. Because when I won the title in 1985 at age 22, chess computers, Ian mentioned them 30 years ago, they were weak. So I remember I played a simultaneous exhibition in Hamburg against 32 chess playing computers. I think most of the audience don't know what it is. They were devices that played only chess. So you should remember that. Yeah, this is, but, and there were four leading producers, manufacturers of these computers, and I played, you know, 32 games. One of them actually was Saitik Kasparov, so I already signed a contract with them. So the only memory, you know, if you call it memories, because I won easily, all the games there, so 32. The only memory is that, you know, in one game, you know, I got in trouble, and the irony is that it was a computer that carried my name. So I immediately thought about, you know, the scandal that will erupt, you know, if I lose this only game and will be accused for some, you know, unfair promotion. Yes, so I managed. So at that time, having a bad position was not a decisive factor. So, and I knew that every machine had tremendous weakness of paying too much attention to the material. So that's why, you know, being so down a pawn, I sacrificed something else, machine grabbed it, and okay, I rubbed it off. So later on, you know, I played other computers, played in 89, so in 91, but okay, the big matches were 96, 97, I played a few more matches. So the moment I left professional chess in 2005, so 10 years ago, I wouldn't say machines were unbeatable, but literally unbeatable. So as this, I think still human world champion, let's say Magnus Carlsen, may face the machine and may win one game, but it's, you know, that's the best we can hope for. Because, you know, machines are, you know, too steady for us to beat, and it's not just about brute force of calculation only, it's about our ability, or in fact, our inability to resist the pressure from the game where opponent doesn't make typical human mistakes. Because, you know, human chess is always full with not necessarily mistakes, inaccuracies. So the way we play chess, the way we do business, the way we, you know, handle complicated private or political affairs, you know, even if we win at the, even if we won at the end, there's still certain elements of inaccuracies, you know, and those minor mistakes, those minor blunders, they are often overlooked when you face human opposition. You play machine? Yeah, so it's done. So, okay, and still today I wanted to talk about just it's a more philosophical question, because the biggest issue today is about how we can live with machines and what does it mean, the progress, the dramatic progress of computers, not only in chess but elsewhere, for our future. So we have to make sure that, you know, we know how to deal with this, we know how to benefit from that, and I'll mention it later in my talk today, you know, whether we should be afraid of that. That's, you know, there are many questions. And one of the interesting questions, you know, when we deal with computers is that, you know, it's when we see new technology, so this is new for our generation, so that's something we live with. And it's always amazing to see how much we're surprised to see new generations that is so normal for our kids or our grandchildren. So I'm always amazed to see how my 8-year-old daughter, you know, handles iPad, iPhone, other things that somehow mysterious to me. So now I know that there are many buttons there, so that I can slide, I can push, but still I'm used to. Even if I know how to handle them, still mentally I belong to previous generation. So so it's the interesting question is that so are we dealing today with a new world, or it's just, you know, it's old world with new tools? Because again, it's about impact of all these technologies to our life. So does it, you know, simply, you know, make us feel more comfortable, or it creates sort of a brand new conditions? So it's whether, you know, technology produces or helps us to come up with new creative ideas. So whether some innovations helping us to come up with more innovations, or we are getting comfortable. Ian mentioned this debate we had here 2.5 years ago. So it's myself and Peter Thiel versus Ken Rogoff and Mark Shuttleworth. And it's again an open-ended question. So it may sound a little bit odd when one side defends the motion that technology is slowing down. Because how come, you know, this is every day we have something new in our hands. But the big question is, do you believe that iPhone 6 is equal to Apollo 6 in terms of exploration? I mean, are we really doing something disruptive? That's why I said it's very philosophical, because we just have to understand, you know, when we say innovations, what do we mean? So iPad applications, or, you know, just new concepts? So we have a lot of new stuff coming in every day, but in medicine, for instance. But can you compare it to penicillin? So I see the slides arrive, so that's why. I don't want to go too far into this debate, because it's a separate issue, but important is just to try to figure out, so whether we can anticipate the effect of the technologies for our daily life, and especially because there are many students here, it's for the job market. Now I need a slide, Mick. Yes, because it's employment chart. I have to I have to show it.
You know how computers feel about you.
No, computers hate me. Yes. That's I know. I established this. Yes. No, it's no cache. No, hopefully this is not an IBM computer, it's Dell. Sure, it should feel much better about me. Yeah. Okay, perfect. No, that's unfortunately we're gonna skip this. Yeah, but wait a second, this what is yeah.
Okay, so where are we starting?
It's employment chart.
There we go. Okay, we're good.
We're good?
Well,
sit down.
Yeah, I'll sit down for a second, make sure.
Okay, and just make sure that it works.
So I don't escape in case anything goes wrong.
Done? Does it work? Wow. Okay, fine. So, okay. Naturally, what we see is the intelligent machines, they disrupt the job market. But it's not here. But that's not my fault. So this is this. Any chance we have, we have both sides of this audience, both wings, to be equally treated? This is, by the way, typical, for politics, only mainstream is respected. So that's why the left and right should be cut, What?
There's no hand solo.
No hand solo?
No hand solo slide.
No hand solo slide? Okay, fine.
And these are combined.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Understood. Still doesn't work. Any chance that we'll manage it? Okay, I'll carry on. Okay, fine. Sorry, by the way, this is something that probably goes without saying it's natural. So when we have brand new technology, something totally disruptive, before it creates jobs, it kills jobs. This is something that sometimes as obvious as it sounds. Often people don't appreciate that because they think, new technology, it has to create jobs. Yes, but before it happens, the old industries, they're disappearing. So now the question is how soon, we can expect new technologies to create these jobs. And according to this, I think it's outdated chart by the UK government, so only small fractions are involved in technology fields, but the reality more and more of nearly every sector is heavily involved with new technology, whether they like it or not. So that's some form of an effect that, for me, proves that we have to live with that. So it happens. So certain things, are beyond our control. I just want to say the weather, but I'm afraid to upset people, that are working on the climate change. So, but it's, I always say that, if it's raining or it's snowing, you can keep complaining about the bad weather or you can, have a warm coat or an umbrella. So my view is that, again, we have to move on. So, and to make sure that we know how to deal with that. So, of course, now, it's about new jobs that are created today. So many of the positions that are created by these new technologies, they didn't even exist 25 years ago. Some of them didn't exist even 10 years ago. So it's what? E-commerce consultant. So social media manager. Social media manager. Before Facebook, it was not, even an opportunity. So data mining specialist. Data mining. So that's also a strange combination of words for a person like me over 50. App developer, genetic counselor, drone pilot, manager or operator of the 3D printer. And the list goes on, and it gets longer every day. So many famous statements about the future of technology and the workforce are becoming obsolete. So you read something and it's just, things change because, it's too fast for us to prepare decent commentaries. So in general, I agree with the idea that if machines are taking jobs, so the best solution is to make more machines. Because, it will always be, there will always be jobs for those who can build and program the machines. Now, what happens with those who don't? I don't know, it's called progress. So you just have to look for something that can be done by people, and I understand that, with people living longer and having, longer and they can spend more time at their workplace, many more years. We have to find a solution. But, you know, digital disruption in orders of magnitude more powerful than mechanical disruption. So that's another example. So that's the auto factory robots. So how many jobs this robot can take away? 20? 200? I mean, I don't know. So this is the, but many people just are needed to design and build these robots and build even better ones. So robots making robots has existed for a while, if I'm correct. And the number of people in manufacturing has dropped in a steady, slow line. So there's still, you know, there's still room. It's all about just us finding the right, the right spot where human creativity will be needed. So it's I think still the pace of having these robots into industrial life, it's slow enough for economics and education systems to adapt. So, but compared to it's to the power of digital substitution, that becomes different. So if an algorithm for speech recognition can replace millions of secretaries, computer diagnostician can replace many, I don't know whether millions or but thousands or tens of thousands of healthcare professionals at a tiny fraction of the cost. So disruption is huge, and job replacement is very hard to see. So productivity goes up, but that doesn't directly help the newly unemployed. So I picked up a phrase, so it's a futurist, Kevin Kelly, had a clear vision of the future of work, at least in the developed world. So you'll be paid in the future based on how well you work with robots. 90% of your co-workers will be unseen machines. Most of what you do will not be possible without them. And there will be a blurry line between what you do and what they do. Again, is it a good picture or bad picture? Is it a bright future or a dark future? My answer is it's happening. So that's why we'd better, you know, get ready. Because standing on the way of the progress, you know, it's never worked. And I'll talk a bit, you know, more about our fear, instinctive fear of this change. But, you know, I always keep this view that we have to make sure that, you know, we move along with the progress. So I've discussed these topics with MIT computer science professor Andrew McCaffey, who had written several important books with a colleague on what he calls the second machine age. So, and I'm always happy when every smart expert like Professor McCaffey like my ideas and expand on them. In his book, he quotes an article I wrote in the New York Review of Books in 2010. It was a review of the book on computers. And I was referring to a chess match I played in 1998 when it's not man versus machine. It was a different form of chess. Man plus machine versus man plus machine. I called it at that time advanced chess. So, because it helped, in my view, it helped to boost human creativity because we could avoid some unnecessary human blunders by having, you know, those electronic assistant next to you, and the opponent had the same luxury. So, and I wrote that the advantage still came down to creating a new idea at some point. And that's also an interesting question to discuss. So, there's one radical view that machines will kill the creativity because they will do everything for us and there's no room for us to create new ideas. I believe to the opposite. Having machines so we can enhance our power, the power of creativity, and we can do more because we can leave some unnecessary stuff, and if we have creative ideas with the machine, we can sort of have, we can give a great boost. It's like a rocket boost for these ideas to be developed faster and in a more sophisticated way. So Professor McCaffey jumped on that point, and since it's exactly that, it's creating ideas, or he called ideation, that computers cannot do. So maybe computers can write clear sentence today, but they cannot decide what to write next. So now about my personal experience, but not in chess. So last October, I was invited to visit the offices of Bridgewater. Sounds boring name, huh? Sounds like a nice local pub. But in fact, it's the largest hedge fund in the world. It's $150 billion under management. So founded by Ray Dalio in 1972. And as you might imagine, Bridgewater is at the cutting edge of trying to get an edge over their competitors and the markets by any possible means. And these days, that usually means technology, especially the computer analysis. But I was very interested to go there when I heard that one of their leading experts was Dave Ferrucci. It's the man that left IBM for Bridgewater, but for obviously for probably some other benefits, but also for quite unusual reason. Dave Ferrucci was a mastermind behind IBM's Watson. I think you maybe heard about it. This is the, it's more people will heard about Deep Blue, but you know, I prefer Watson. Yeah, it's like, you know, hardware project, which was Deep Blue, only with, you know, 256 processors. It's a parallel processors, you know, a pyramid. And Watson is a software product, and it crushed humans in Jeopardy. Slightly different game. Actually, I think it was a significant progress in helping machines to move to a new level. So Ferrucci was the man behind the project, and he was not happy with IBM trying to monetize the Watson and just trying to use it for sort of healthcare advice programs, and he wanted to continue his research. And ironically, he left IBM for Bridgewater. It's not that, you know, Bridgewater, you know, did it as a matter of charity. Naturally, they were looking for this edge, but it's quite funny to see that, you know, it's, sometimes research happens not in the corporation that is supposed to do it, but in a hedge fund. Okay, let me just put this. So my conversations at Bridgewater, which included Ferrucci and several top managers and quantitative analysts, quants, and programmers, broke down into an interesting debate that was, for me, it was almost philosophical. Now, the question is, will greater success and progress with our intelligent machines come from developing ways to analyze past information, or from teaching them some rules and letting them figure it out? So the basic question, so do you want to load the whole data you have into the computer and look for, you know, for the machine analyzing patterns of the past and moving forward, or you want to teach it, you know, basic laws of physics or whatever science you need for machine to know and see what happens? So one doesn't exclude another because, you know, of course, there's overlap in these methods. And probably, ideally, they have to be combined in both right now being pursued. So another topic that crosses the boundaries of biology and philosophy or whether or not the human brain is simply an incredibly fast computer that could, with sufficiently advanced technology, be emulated. And I admit I didn't have a ready answer to this question from a young analyst at this debate in Bridgewater, because I was asked directly. It's quite a fascinating reaction of these young experts that they're always looking for ways to sort of quantify any problem. So this is brain. Can we emulate it? Now, I responded that a perfect digital brain would still not know when to decide. So this is timing factor. Because you can collect all the data, all the information, but still it's for human decide at what point we stop collecting this data and we want to sort of change the analytical mode into the decision-making mode. And I think that this gets to the human element and the human role. So how long you take to make a decision and how much time to allocate and the pressure we feel. And it's all very human issues. I remember this, is, again, going back to my chess career, one of the lessons that I learned at early stage of my professional chess career from my coach and second, Alexander Nikitin. It was probably 74, 75, I was 11, 12, pretty good player at the time already. So, and we were watching some of the matches. I think it's one of the Anatoly Karpov's early matches. And he told me, look, when you have two strong players of about equal strengths, the decisive advantage is always with one of them who can make decisions with less hesitations. Because we always have food to chew while thinking. So there's always move here and there, and it's unless you see the force made in five or in six moves, there's always, you know, room for hesitations. You know, I could come up with some of the examples from my own career when I could see different options, let's say two moves that, you know, both were risky and I couldn't anticipate which one to choose. Now, and it goes back to psychology. So if I was in a good shape, if I was in a really good form and I could, you know, cut my thinking somewhere just at one point, saying, okay, 20 minutes enough, 25 minutes enough, just move. Because hesitations and doubts, they create more hesitations and more doubts. It's like, you know, if the fear of to make a mistake almost guarantees that you will make a mistake, because the fear dominates your mind. So it's very psychological. So the strengths of a top player, the winner, is just, you know, he believes that, you know, his decisions are good enough and he can move on without wasting time on contemplating again and again, when he knows that nothing can be added because there's no force line. It's all about making decisions. Now, using intuition, but that's probably another story. So without getting the inter-realm of consciousness, so we can still discuss at what point a machine is capable of ideation, using the term from McCarthy, and of asking questions instead of answering them. So Ferrucci, in our conversation, argued that computers today can ask questions. They just don't know what is important. So, doesn't make any sense. So it's still not definitely a sign of intelligence. So, and that's what gives us a competitive edge, because only a human knows the why, the big question, the why. So why this question matters. So we have motivations, priorities, a life full of wants and needs. Computers will never have these things, probably. Now, I tried to raise some of these questions today at the seminar just a few hours ago in the Side Business School. So, and I wanted just to share this result. So that's why we were with a slight delay. This isn't just to understand again, but we're trying to understand the strengths and weaknesses. So we're human. So we look at this now, 23 multiple 176. Now, you don't have to calculate. You know the right answer just without computation, because it's there. So now, the moment you go to the 49 multiple 93, you have to start thinking a little bit. Depends how fast you can calculate, but you need to think, because the answer is not you can do it quickly, but just not everybody can. So, but again, it takes some time. Even if it's an extra second, but still, you know, we spend time, because if the first case we can solve, because we know it's right, we don't even think about it. We don't try to find the reason why we know it's there. Now, so for us, and it's there's a difference in these two cases. And of course, I can make them far more radical. So just to start pushing them. So now, for the computer, it doesn't make any difference. So machine will spend the same time. Whether it does, it's because it computes, and it will be always a split of a second. Now, of course, you can start making it bigger, and while human solutions will vary in time, machines will be always the same. And I think, again, it shows both, you know, strengths and weakness of human intuition. So it's the definitely it's you know it's it start with we can start with the strengths, because again we can stop calculating. So it's if imagine we have a very complicated problem and guiding the machine can save us a lot of time, because we know that certain things we shouldn't do. So simply because we know that, whether it's again chess, politics, business, whatever, science. So very often we can just stop and direct the machine in doing something which is vital, because we know it's vital. Now, then, I had another test just to look at our weakness. So, I had a couple of questions. So, don't look at your mobile devices. Yes, that's what I ask students. So, how tall is the tallest tree in the world? And what is the average annual temperature in Damascus? Actually, I have to confess there was a third question, you know, what was, you know, when Gandhi died, so at what age? So, but that's, you know, it was like, you know, a teaser, because, you know, many, many students didn't know the answer. So that's more, tallest tree and Damascus are less obvious. The reason we asked that, because we distributed also the handouts, and the first question was, included a number. That, for instance, how tall is the tallest tree? Is it above or below 400 meters, 1,300 feet? And each group, seven groups, we moved down. So, and the last one had something like 20 meters. So the same with temperature in Damascus. It started from 48 Celsius to 3 Celsius. Now, I was actually curious to find out whether the results that have been received by the scientists who did it with a much bigger groups, and I would say probably with less intelligent people than the Oxford MBA students, so whether results will be the same or similar, because it's a small group and it's a very intelligent group and it's a very international group. So that's why you expect that results might differ. You look at the results. Now remember that the top group receives excessive number on one side, so the much higher number. The seventh group receives the lowest number. And look what the answer is, because psychologically, this is a problem of humans. Even if this number has nothing to do with reality, you still look at this, and your answer, combined answer, is affected. Just enjoy it. That's what the groups received, and look at the answers that they gave. So with just, you know, minor exception on the top, which are two excessive groups. So the rest is falls in line. Now, just to have the, it's an anecdote that happened when we got the results. The group seven actually had a result 97, and I hated it. Meg and I looked at this as, wow, 97, damn it, just it destroys such a nice picture. He said, no, it's 97 feet. He said. So, and then it worked perfectly. Yeah, so it's, okay, sometimes, you know, like with this, the Mars probe, you know, if you forget to make the conversion, so you can lose the multi-billion dollar project. So in our case, actually, it worked nicely. So it's, you know, I was pleasantly surprised. So just to see that, you know, it proves again that, you know, we have our limitations, because we are vulnerable to things that are irrelevant from the machine's point of view. So again, we have advantages and disadvantages. So in my view, and I've been advocating it for a long time, it should be an advanced version of advanced chess. It's all about, you know, finding the way to combine our creativity and they call it intuition. So this is something that, you know, just helps us to rely on the past experience without making any computation. And the machine's brute force of calculation and machine's indifference to anything, you know, bad weather, good weather, stock market goes up or down, so whatever. It does what it does best. So now we try to move on to predicting the future, how we combine these things and how we move into the future. Now, we talked about it, and this is not, you know, it doesn't come from a religious source. It's not, you know, something obscure. Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking. Artificial intelligence is the biggest existential threat. Oh, okay. It's probably Oxford is the right place to challenge this. Going back to Bridgewater. So the goal of Bridgewater, as any hedge fund, is to predict the future. Basically, so they know how the markets will move in advance. So there are two main complications we discussed. There are two main, so beyond the technology and moving into the areas like, you know, game theory. First is the competition. It's not an issue for pure research, but for a hedge fund or a company working on predicting terrorist attacks by analyzing collected intelligence data like Palantir in Silicon Valley, it's critical. This is even if you develop a great model, but your opponent, your competitors, figure out how it works and they can adjust to fool it. A computer can learn the best play in poker, for example, by simply calculating the odds with all available information. And it will be always superior to humans by calculating the odds. Now, how can it calculate the bluff? So that suddenly there's an element that, you know, cannot be computed. So that's why if the poker player knows something about the algorithm of the machine, we know the outcome. So that's the good poker player probably will make a fool of the machine. So the other complication is sort of like quantum physics. So how much do the actions of your model affect the data and therefore the model itself? So simply observing can affect the data. So manipulating, it definitely will. So analyzing a moving target is hard enough, but it may also move due to your attempts to analyze and monitor it. So it's not just the market changes. There could be some elements. And they can be changed, not necessarily because somebody was trying to fool you and your system, but because of other factors. It's easier in chess. Chess is like a bubble. So you play, you know, within, you know, the fixed rules. You know, you have number of pieces. So everybody follows the same pattern in terms of the rules. Now, there's so many factors there, so unlimited number of them, that could affect, you know, our ability to predict the future because some elements of the system can change. So at best, we can deal with the odds. So we can expect to improve our odds in predicting the future. So the discussion, you know, ended up with this fundamental question. So how many rules you should teach the machine? It comes up with that. So, and I wanted to summarize it. So wow. Mick, is it right? I'm just looking at this. It's a day in history. That's if I can figure it out. Because today, in 1847, if I remember correctly, Thomas Edison was born. And that's him. So it's the part of the progress. So this is how we move forward. So with our ability or being audacious to challenge the sort of the status quo, the conventional wisdom. So that's somehow a response to, in my view, to the warnings from these great minds and great inventors like Elon Musk or Stephen Hawking. There's something else I just wanted to mention just to wrap up this conversation is that We have cases that are challenging, you know, our ability to not just to predict the future, but also just to live in the present. So, for instance, the Paris attack, the tragedy, terrible tragedy. And when we deal with these situations, now the question is, so what do we do? So there are two different ways of moving forward. You can start blocking everything, or you can come up with new bright ideas, trying to sort of outpace any competition. In one of my latest editorials, so I call it sort of it's a time factor in the globalization. Because when we talk about globalization, we always think about the space. So things happening everywhere in the world. So it moves from here to there. So you can move businesses, funds, people can fly around this, you know, change their locations where they live and they work. So it's all good. So like it's a positive sign. But every coin has two sides. Now the problem is that, you know, the moment you start doing this and you enjoy it sorely, you also open the gates, because it's not a one-way street. You open the gates for those who live in the past. The world is not a place where, you know, everybody lives at the same, I won't say time zone, but not also at the same timeline. And the moment you create these channels of communication, you bring these people into contacts with modernity. And in many parts of the world, modernity is the existential threat to the regimes, to the all sorts of thugs, dictators, religious crazies. The very power they concentrate in their hands based on the rejection of modernity. The archaic ideas are just always, you know, it's in the core of their political power. So they have to resist, because the success of free market, liberal democracy, and other related ideas that constitute the strengths of our society, they are, as I said, create an existential threat for these guys. So they fight back. They fight back, and how they can fight back? Can they fight with new ideas? No. Can they fight with, you know, some creativity, some future vision? No, because their future is based on the past. The only competitive advantage they have is the value of human life. For them, it's nothing. For us, it's everything. So we just, we are proud that we today, we value human life, and we believe that this human life is unique, and we know about the uniqueness of human life, and that's why we do everything to save every life that, you know, that we're able to save. So we can't drop anybody behind. For them, 1 million dead is statistics. They learned it from the dictators of the past. So the question is, so what do? We build blocks, we build new doors, you know, castles, fortresses, or we move in the opposite direction. And I heard comments from the Prime Minister of the UK, Mr. Cameron, who advocated this, in my view, an outdated approach. Let's, you know, have new security systems, internet. Let's crack on some of the free channels of information, because that will prevent bad guys from hurting us. I would stick with the opposite side, also from this country. Let's look at, and recently I'm sure many of you saw The Imitation Game. So probably the greatest mind of this, one of the greatest minds of the 20th century. And it was exactly the opposite. So you come up with new ideas. You come up with something disruptive. You come up with something that puts you way ahead of the competition. So I think this is the challenge, and that's why, you know, I put the Thomas Edison quote. So I believe that with all the threats, whether they come from artificial minds, so potential artificial intelligence, or with the bad guys who use devices that have been created and produced in our part of the world to hurt us, we still have, you know, our way to move forward. And it's also somehow reflected in the way the books are being written. 50, 60 years ago, in the 50s and 60s of the 20th century, the science fiction was full of positive utopia. So great future, we can have machines cooperating with humans, we can fly to Moon, Mars, you know, other planets beyond solar system, and on Earth we can do this and that. It's the future looked bright. Later, you know, you can see this how it developed in the opposite direction. Machines are no longer friends. This is Terminators. It's Skylab, you know, is being built, you know, just to kill all of us. And instead of having this positive outlook of this distant and bright future, we now the genre is gradually changed into the fantasy. So we'd rather read about elves and magic than about the magic that can be produced by human genius. And going back to the debate that Ian mentioned, myself and Peter Thiel have been not accused, but we were portrayed by our opponents as those who are pessimistic, because we didn't think that human race haven't developed fast enough, that we missed many opportunities, it's not true because we're doing so many great things. But to the contrary, we were the optimists, because we believe that we are not yet doing what we could. So we are way behind our ability to innovate and to come up with the great disruptive ideas. And there's always room. When Alan Turing wrote his first paper in 1937, I mean, just nobody even knew what is a computer. So somebody came up with an idea that never existed. So that's what still could be done. And when somebody asks, you know, what else we could do, because it's so, you know, there's so many things happen already, and there's no room for new generation to come up with new great ideas, because it have been developed all the time. Oh, you can mention that in 1902, I think, the head of the American Patent Bureau wanted to close his shop because he thought that everything was already patented. No, it doesn't, you know. Life comes in seasons. And, there's always room for us to do something new. And just remember, I keep giving this piece of trivia because, and I know it's probably become trivial already, but it just tells me that there's so much can be done when we complain that that's all these big devices, you know, they are in the hands of everybody. We just don't appreciate how much power today we carry with us. How much memory, how much power of computation. It's like an advanced chess. You can create more if you have machines on the other side, powerful machine. In 1969, when Americans landed on the moon, the entire computing power of NASA was the size of one iPhone. Probably less if it's iPhone 6. Just imagine how much these people could do to bring the man to the moon and actually to calculate trajectory to fly back safely. Using 128 kilobytes? It just shows that there are no limits for human genius. So that's my positive message. I believe that there's plenty of room for us, providing we are optimists, and we believe in our genius, and we believe in a bright future. And we should not be afraid of anything which is produced by human genius, because it's produced by us. So that's why, at new level, we as a human race could be more successful and come up with even brighter ideas as a human race, because some of us may not succeed. Okay, it happens. But we will move together, we will move forward. And that's my positive message. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. The purpose of the Oxford Martin School, which I'm privileged to be the director of, is to bring great minds together to think about the toughest challenges of the 21st century. And we've been really privileged to have your wonderful mind, a beautiful mind which is not only able to be the best chess mind in the world, but also think about how this is going to interact. And we certainly share with you the optimism about what it can bring. We're creating new programs on employment and technology, and also, of course, our Future of Humanity and other institutes are working on these very questions that you've discussed. We have about just over 20 minutes for discussion and Q&A. There are roving mics. This is being filmed, so if you would not like to be filmed, I suggest you don't say anything. And who'd like to go first? Please identify yourself. Yep.
If you're planning to apply for Russian visa, you shouldn't probably ask the question.
Thank you for an excellent talk, by the way. By way of identifying myself, I'm lucky enough to be a father.
Is that on? No.
I can hear it, but I'm afraid that...
I can speak louder if you like.
Let's check the mics on, please.
I think it's a pretty big audience, so, and of course I can repeat the question, but it's...
Is that better for you? How about that?
Yep.
I'm lucky enough to be a father of one of the students at St. Catherine's College. Thank you for an excellent talk. I'd be interested in how you feel human creativity could be linked to computing power to enhance our thinking and our abilities.
Well, I think there are numerous ways. I think that's this is exactly for human creativity to find the most effective ways, because I believe the options are unlimited. So, as I said, you know, more technologies, more devices in our hands will eventually create new opportunities. And you know, sometimes people ask me in these talks, in the conversations and seminars, but we are working in an X company. And we have to come up with a plan for innovations. We have to come up with new products. But we need to put it, you know, just to some data, some hard data. So how much will it cost? How much time will it take? My answer is, if you know how much will it cost and how much will it take, it's obsolete.
See any other hands?
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Julian Savulescu. I'm in the Oxford Martin School in the Institute for Science and Ethics. I wonder if I could ask you a slightly offbeat question. In all those thousands of hours in professional chess playing human opponents, what did you learn about human psychology?
That sounds like the beginning of a new lecture. Naturally, everything I learned was a result of this interaction, but it's a very specific interaction because it's a challenge. So it's one-on-one. I was not looking so much for generalities, but for the specifics of each opponent, especially when you play a long match. So that's why I'm not sure that I can sort of be very general in describing the certain traits or the strengths of the character. Though I could probably help in working out a psychological portrait of an opponent if we want to describe, you know, the qualities and weaknesses, the strengths and the weaknesses of hypothetical opponent that will be facing us, whether it's in chess or elsewhere. But again, I always knew the limitations of my ability to learn because it was quite specific. It's like a very sort of very narrow path. So I knew what I needed. So and I was quite good at just and getting that data, and I wasn't sure I can, you know, I can give a lecture on that.
Great. Yeah, over there.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Oh,
Yes.
Wow.
We're having major problems with the technology this year.
That's exactly. We talk about technology.
I'm working in computer science, but I've also been involved in chess programming. I would like to ask a question about, there are still positions, I think, for example, king engines, where computers seem at least a few years ago, they still often played quite poorly with whites in certain positions, but they just avoid these positions. What is your position? Do you still think today that there are certain type of positions you could set up certain endgames where you simply still think that computers are kind of have certain shortcomings?
So
to ask such a technical question.
Naturally, you know, there are certain positions where machines are not as good as humans, and those are, it's quite a limited number of positions. When I say limited, we're still talking about probably infinite number, but compared to the rest, it's a tiny segment. Positions, so-called closed positions, with the sort of the pawn chains that cut the board, so where you don't have sort of immediate interactions of the pieces. So that's something that, you know, requires long maneuvers. So as a chess player, you know that in one of my matches, it's against Deep Fritz in 2003, I won a game which looked, you know, as an awful game played by the computer, because it reached this position, which, by the way, was not even better for me, but it was close. So for machine, you know, just it's whether it calculates 5 million positions per second, 10 or 20, it doesn't make any difference, because still the number of moves are limited. There are too many pieces aboard, but these pieces, you know, you move it from here to there, it doesn't create, you know, any changes. So as long as the pieces are not interacting, so machines are vulnerable, because they sometimes they don't see them, the pieces. They just don't exist. So it's, but again, an ability of human players to reach these positions against computers that are prepared for the match is almost zero today, because any good programmer will make sure that the openings will work, you know, to avoid these potential traps. So, and also this is just giving one more comment about the openings is, you know, machines benefited quite dramatically from learning the openings and going through this opening stage without sort of major problems or hurdles. But, you know, at one point, you know, programmers discovered that the opening theory that they have been downloading into the computers also could have a flawed data. Because now with stronger computers, you can discover that at move 12 or 13, something was wrong there that was not seen before. So that brings us to the same issue. Do we want, you know, machines to rely on the data that might have flaws? And while, you know, machine will be predicting the future or playing chess, it's much smaller scale of predicting the future, it might become a victim of something that is there, and it will be too late for machine to discover this gap in its knowledge.
Thank you very much. On this idea that we are innovating below our potential, what do you see are some of the general things that we're doing wrong and that we should be doing differently?
I think this is psychological. I think that we live in a risk-averse society. And again, it's a long story, and we could start, you know, arguing why certain things happen or certain things have not happened. But it's very clear that today, when we look at any venture or adventure, so we always try to eliminate the risk or to reduce the risk without recognizing, or sometimes we don't want to accept the fact that risk reduction means eventually profit reduction. So we are trying to compensate our risk-averse policies with some artificial means to sort of boost productivity and to encourage people to do certain new things. I mean, like, you know, printing money. So we try to come up with something that, you know, in my view, just doesn't work in the free market. So the whole idea of too big to fail, in my view, just contradicts the fundamental principles of capitalism. You go back to 60s and 70s, you could probably trace this moment where we just thought the baby boomers as a generation thought that it was a great opportunity to benefit from decades of phenomenal boost for innovations. It seems to us that when we talk about things that we carry, that is something great is happening. But we are not recognizing that it's not disruptive. It's still the same. It's the basically, you know, we have things that are doing the same, faster, more efficient, but still the same. So we're not moving, you know, from what I call from horizontal to vertical level, because we're afraid of risk. And you know, we always look at the you know, odds, and sometimes again we don't recognize that it's irrelevant. And I just mentioned about this a few minutes ago about the computing power of NASA. And sometimes I think that if computing power of NASA was sufficient at that time to calculate the odds of safe return, probably the Americans would never land on the moon, because no U.S. president will authorize the mission with, I don't know, 25% chance of failure. And I think that probably the chances were even higher. So we're looking always for different ways of just reducing risk. And the reason why I'm arguing for riskier missions as human flight to Mars. It's not necessarily, you know, just to go there and just to put someone's flag there, or just even to dig something from this red planet to come up with stones or dust. But what happens in the history of disruptive innovations is not the innovation itself, but the periphery. What happens on the periphery? The side effect. Okay, John Armstrong on moon, great. But ARPANET and GPS as byproducts of the space race are far more important. So flying to Mars, okay, I don't know what will happen. And maybe eventually it could fail. I'm sure there will be many volunteers, but there's a good chance they will never come back. But what will happen with medicine, with new food products, with our way to supply, you know, oxygen for human bodies? So many things must happen to support it. And if today, while dealing with pharmaceuticals, with new drugs, you have to deal with ratio of 1 to 1,000. One failure out of 1,000, you might be out of business. No authority will give you chance to come up with this new drug, even if it potentially saves millions of lives. The moment you start operating in a new environment, like, you know, fly to Mars, and your chances of return 50-50, 1 out of 3 will work for you. So that's what you dramatically change the ratio. And it's again, trying to calculate the odds, it's not always works. Whether, you know, that your chances of flying back to Mars and back safely are 42% or 39% is basically irrelevant. So what were the chances of Columbus to come back? I don't think it's... If they had an insurance company at that time, I think he would be uninsurable, because, you know, it's, you know, he didn't even know where he was heading for. So... And I always say that it's safer today to fly to Mars than for Columbus to cross the Atlantic, because at least we know the distance.
Great. Over here. Thank you. I'm Peter Millikan, professor of philosophy at Hartford College. I agree entirely about how human imagination, coupled with the use of computers, both in chess and life, can be far more powerful than either individually. You can use the computer to explore possibilities far more complicated than the unaided human mind could do. My question to you is about education. So my students studying computer science and philosophy are very well placed to exploit this new possibility. But this requires a combination of understanding and skills that is probably quite rare. Are we going to have to change the way we educate people to make sure that we don't only have a small elite who are able to capitalize on this possibility, leaving most people behind?
It's a question more political, you know. It's about our social life, about the political consequences. Some people are warning, some people are dreaming about the society with stars, superstars, and the rest. So I'm not happy with this vision. My experience again, it's a chess experience, chess in education. I've been promoting the idea of having chess in education, in the classroom at early age. And I built Kasparov Chess Foundation, starting in New York and then in Europe, in Johannesburg for Africa, in Asia, and in Latin America, and a few regional foundations. And I learned a lot about educational systems in different continents, and some of them were very sophisticated, some of them were quite poor. But what I found out that the talent is spread evenly around the world. It's all about finding the talent. So that's why I see no danger of, you know, of us having very, you know, just a small elitist club as long as we deal with numbers. There's nothing, you know, unique of Soviet Union being so good in chess for a simple reason, because there were very few options available for kids. So that's why parents wanted to check whether kids could play chess or do music or ballet. So the number of options, this number was limited. So in America was the opposite. So that's why America could find only one Bobby Fischer, because it had maybe 50,000 kids going through the system. When you have 5 million, you have different numbers. As long as we can guarantee that these numbers will go through the even primitive educational system, but we'll have a chance to actually learn about this modern technology and sort of basic education, I think that the flow of the talent will never stop.
Okay. Was there a hand right in the back there?
Well, I see there, and I see there.
Yeah, I'm back. Actually looking for a woman's hand at this point.
Ah.
This is a question about human rights and artificial intelligence. With the news full of horrendous war, conventional war going on and people suffering throughout the world, and you mentioned David Cameron and having a slightly outdated approach, how can you see in the future we could maybe use artificial intelligence means to disrupt, or whatever word you want to use, these kind of conventional wars which are causing so many human rights problems?
The human conflicts, they will probably never cease to exist. Though, if we look at the global political map, we could see that, you know, the wars happen when, you know, when the political systems in their respective countries are not developed to have sort of proper connections with people. Just set aside Ukraine for a moment. Except Yugoslavia, there were no wars in Europe since 1945. So even with all the differences between some European countries, you can't imagine France and Germany, you know, trying to solve these differences by, you know, using arms. Though they had about 1,000 years of history fighting each other. So what we know from history, the democratic countries, they don't fight because there are other instruments. So my view is that, you know, we have to move forward by containing those that are threatening the global order. And I believe that we are in the position to do it, because uniquely, probably the first time in human history, the force of democracy is much more powerful, both militarily and economically. I think that coming up with new ideas, with new technologies, with artificial intelligence, that should be a response, because at the end of the day, we have means to approach billions of people. And we have to keep, you know, informing them. It's, you know, it's not easy, because the bad guys also have, you know, have the same means of communication now. But we just have to make sure that the ideas that we present, they just offer a better future. And again, numbers are changing in our favor, in favor of modernity. That's why the response from the opposite side is getting so aggressive and so violent, because they know they long term they will be losing. So we just have to come up with more new ideas. So that's why, again, more openness, just to make sure that people will feel the benefits of the free world and the ideas, again, going back to education, that will bring them into the world, will not leave them behind. I think that with new ideas, with new technologies, with new approaches going, you know, to the space, going to, you know, to deep waters, the oceans, we'll find room for these people to get excited. So we need this, the human race needs to excite its youngsters and also people that, you know, have adventure in their blood.
I'm afraid we've only got time for a couple of very quick questions, and I'm afraid, Gary, quick responses. I'm going to take the two women who've put up their hands, you and...
Hi, Hannah Maslin from the Oxford Martin School. So I liked your overall optimistic message, but I was wondering if, aside from perhaps certain weapons, there were any new technologies that you thought were particularly regrettable?
New technologies?
That are regrettable.
I don't understand, you know, that are regrettable. For me, it sounds like oxymoron. Because technology is not good or bad, you know, it's anything that we can come up potentially could be damaging and could be regrettable. You can have a nuclear power station or you can have a nuclear bomb. What is regrettable in my view, that is just some of these technologies, you know, we stop exploration. So we just, you know, we did something and then we just, okay, it's done, and as we move elsewhere. Because unpredictability of the human progress, I think it's a main condition of its success. The moment you want to limit something, if I don't know whether you meant, you know, the cloning, you know, some genetic research, I don't know, but you can't stop it. Because, you know, it's those are the laws that, in my view, above human ability to regulate. Because the moment you try to regulate them, you will harm the entire process. Because, you know, this humans are different. Somebody doesn't like this one, and you may not like this one. So, and there will be no agreement how to limit it. So that's why, again, I'm in favor of us just moving forward. You know, I believe that's why I'm an optimist. I believe in the wisdom of the human race. We'll figure it out. If not us, the next generation will figure it out.
Thank you. I was particularly intrigued by what you said about the vulnerabilities of human intuition. And I wondered whether, with a hypothetical, perfectly designed computer with perfect data, whether that's something that you see to be free of vulnerability altogether?
So go back to square one. So it's now intuition is actually one of the tests today in the Side Business School was describing intuition. So, and we looked for a number of words that have been used by students. So one of the most popular was subconscious. So I don't think that machine, even if you imagine a conscious machine, so this is, it's something that just it's not quantifiable. Because yes, intuition relies on your past experience somehow, but it also, you know, brings into evaluation factors like, you know, how important is the moment. So is it, because same situation, but you know, it could be slightly different, and decision made today is far more important than one that will be made tomorrow. While machine we'll be dealing with, you know, it's you cannot program all the factors that can all the variables that can affect you. So that's probably brings us back to the Turing test. So it's whether machine will be able to respond to the same question in different ways, or always the. So far the answer is probably negative, because it's the ability to vary. Within the same equation, it exclusively stays with humans.
Great, Gary. Just before we thank you, this is one of a series of public events that the Oxford Martin School is having on the 24th of February, Tuesday, the 24th. Chris Lintott, who's a professor of astrophysics, is talking about the trip to Philae, the comet. You'll know Chris is now the presenter of The Sky at Night, taking Patrick Moore's place, and this is obviously part of this deep space challenge and a quite extraordinary technological achievement. On Monday, the 2nd of March, Dame Sally Davis, who's the UK's chief medical officer, is going to be talking about the ticking time bomb, antibiotic resistance. And this is obviously about a theme which we're very keenly involved in, which is the management of the global commons. If we all take antibiotics, will they still work? And then on the 4th of March, a couple of days later, Vlatko Vedral, who is the co-director of our program on bio-inspired quantum technologies, will talk about living in a quantum world. All of those, except Dame Sally Davis, will be at the Oxford Martin School, and Dame Sally Davis will be here. Look at the Oxford Martin School's website, and do also come to our seminar series every Thursday at 5 o'clock on climate change and how to stop it. And tomorrow we're going to be talking about this disconnect between the science and what people feel on climate change. So you're very welcome to those and all our other events, and we very much hope, Gary, this is your fourth visit, you're a senior fellow with us. We hope you'll come back many times, and we greatly look forward to exploring these issues further for you. And thank you so much for your insight tonight.